Hi, I'm Terry Meekin. Welcome to Roving Report. In this week's Roving Report, we'll find out what it's like to constantly stand in the doorway between life and death when we talk to another bomb disposal expert. I went off to a secret location to interview him and asked him first how he got into the business.
Well, I got into it through the United States Army. I joined the service in 05. In October of 06, I was a trained explosive ordnance disposal technician. I spent 6 years as an EOD officer, and I went to Iraq 2 times for a total of 27 months.
Before you actually went into bomb disposal, and I'll call it that because the explosive hazard mitigation is going to be a mouthful throughout the program, we call it bomb disposal. Did you choose that as a profession, or did the Army say, "Oi, you, that's for you"?
No, absolutely. It was a decision of mine to make. They say you have to volunteer twice, once for the military and then once to join the EOD. At the time, it was just during the start of the Iraq War. They were really trying to recruit hard, but it still hadn't gained a lot of momentum. There was an individual in our class in one of the courses that we had as young officers, and he brought this up that there was a competition in order to get one of these slots. So I competed against 90 other officers and was awarded a slot.
Did you know what you were letting yourself in for, or was it... what exactly drove you in that direction rather than painting stones white?
That's true. Well, the other option for me at that time, I was in the Ordnance Corps, was either ammunition, maintaining stockpiles, inventorying them, things like that, or fixing vehicles and overseeing mechanics. So in my mind's eye, that was pretty close to painting stones white. So this was kind of the adventure that...
Right, so you go through the door mark training. What's the packages of training they give you in order to become competent and make sure you come out the other end in one piece?
The whole course is approximately a year. It starts off in Redstone, Alabama. You do a preliminary course learning about ordnance, the functions of ordnance, some of the safeties you need to address, and also some of the technologies and tools that we utilize. From there, you go on to the actual EOD school, and that deals, it's broken down into the core modules where you learn your basics, tools where once again you learn both the high tech, which is robots, advanced explosive charges, and also the low tech. We can unseat a bomb fuse utilizing a pipe wrench from 200 meters away.
What, using a robot?
No, this one's actually just using rope or line, as the Navy calls it, and a pipe wrench.
Do they still use this technique of steaming out charges and things like that? Trepanning, I think they call it, don't they?
Yeah, they do, actually. It's all dependent on the force. In the United States, and for the most part in Britain, what we do is focus on the fusing system. So the thing that actually makes it explode, and we'll attack that. However, there are countries like Japan and some other countries, they'll focus on the explosives itself. So they'll look at getting into what we call the casing, or the steel body of the ordnance, and removing the explosives. So if the fuse decides to detonate, then it's basically just going to be a little firework. The way we attack it, it's less invasive, and it's kind of like a one-shot, one-off thing.
So you prefer to remove the fuse rather than the explosive. And that's the American way of doing it as opposed to the British way of doing it. Is that?
Well, I think the Brits focus on the fuse as well. Yeah. The U.S. EOD is actually based on the British EOD to some extent, because this is where it first happened during the Blitz. And that's where the majority, the bulk of the data and the old techniques, old but effective techniques, were learned through the loss of life.
The arms profession is a big business. Mm-hmm. Is it like a James Book of bombs? There's a James Book of ships?
Yes, there's huge databases. And there's continual testing to do what we call render safe procedures on these different devices.
If you buy them in, do you individually, and you've got, or at least somebody's had some hands-on experience of diffusing almost every type of manufactured device, apart from the IEDs made out by the by the locals in Afghanistan and places like that.
Even with those, we still catalog those. Even those IEDs that are completely random and kind of one-offs, those will still get cataloged, and people will, in their reports, say how they dealt with it, the future way to deal with it, things like that. Because all that information continues to build. It may sound odd, but in those databases, it has cannonballs from the 1860s, the American Civil War, in our database. And the reason it's there is because we still run those incidents as bomb squad in the United States.
You mean you still find cannonballs? Yes. And you have to go and disperse them?
Yeah, believe it or not, it sounds wild, but and they're really dangerous because they've got the black powder. It's been aged for so long, it becomes very, very sensitive.
What's your technique to deal with cannonballs then?
Obviously, we isolate it and try and remove it from any place where it's going to do any damage. And then the difficult part is determining whether it is actually full of explosive or just a lead weight, essentially. We'll x-ray it, and then we can shoot a small explosive charge into it, a shape charge, that'll basically send a hot jet of molten metal and superheated air into it and detonate it.
What, in your view, is the trickiest one to deal with?
Some of the most difficult to deal with are the submunitions, the cluster bombs, if you will, because they're so intricate, they're so small, and there's so many of them. Some of the more difficult ones will shoot out remote wires and have multiple triggering systems, acoustic, so any noise they can tell a vehicle or human foot traffic coming towards it, metallic, so they can tell if there's ferrous metals approaching it.
And they mix up all these in different, in one bomb. Do they, the different sensors do different things, or does one bomb contain a number of clusters with all the same sensor in?
They can mix them up, and that's when it becomes really difficult, is when you don't know. You have all these different safeties and all these different potentials that could set this explosive off, and because you may or may not know what its trigger is, you have to adhere to all those safeties.
You end up diffusing a cluster bomb, which is a case which has got small clusters inside, or do you end up trying to find the small clusters because they've come out and they haven't gone off?
You get both. Normally, in Western base ordnance, you have a dud rate of approximately 10%. So 10% of all the ordnance that you drop or shoot or whatever isn't going to function as designed, as we say. So you may get ordnance in any type of configuration. It may have fallen off the wing of a plane on a tarmac, still encased, and you need to deal with the fusing system itself to prevent the expulsion of all these other smaller charges. So you can find it full up. You can also find them as they have in, like, say, Cambodia and Vietnam and other areas where they're dispersed all over the jungle, all over the place. So you run into just about everything.
I think Joe Public always considers a bomb disposal profession, the people in it, to always be standing on the doorway between life and death. But it seems to me that you're saying that a lot of it is technology-led nowadays, and a human being going up to defuse a bomb is the last resort. Are we talking about percentages here? 90% is diffused by mechanical means, and 10% left over for the poor Joe that's got to walk up and sort it out.
As far as percentages, I would probably say something like that. Unfortunately, there are some situations where the area is so sensitive or there's lives at stake that it does require a hands-on approach.
Have you been up the sharp end of the stick?
Yeah, I have.
A bit sweaty, I guess, at that time, I should imagine.
Yeah.
First time, right?
No, it doesn't change. You definitely get that heart thumping and that adrenaline going. You know, but what's worse is having to dress out in the bomb suit and everything else like that, somebody else, for them to go down there. Because you're very close to that person. They're on your team. You've worked with them. You've lived with them. And to put them in the bomb suit and to put them in harm's way, and you to sit back and say, oh, do your thing, that is really difficult.
You were an officer there, weren't you?
Yes.
So you actually had to sort of mix and match. You say, right, Joe, he went yesterday, Fred, you go today. Is that the way you try and balance the risks?
Yeah, absolutely. We would have different rotation plans. It's a lot like a fire station. We've got teams that are on primary, secondary, and then standby. So we would be able to launch from any one base. It depends on the situation, but we were spread pretty thin. We could launch up to 4 teams at any one time, but that would rarely happen. Mm-hmm. So we would have people in a rotation and also people on the down cycle as well.
You did say it was hard. Did you lose anybody in this environment in your team, or did you come through unscathed at the end of the tour?
No, I was fortunate. All of the soldiers that I went over there with came back. That's a testament to them, and that's a testament to the people that trained them. As we say, better lucky than good.
So, yeah. What about specialized ordnance, nuclear? Do you get some exposure and overview of that yourselves?
Mm-hmm. We do have a precursory kind of crash course in the nuclear side of it, both in actual high yield, as we call them, real nuclear devices, and dispersal devices. Or
dirty bombs.
Dirty bombs, yeah. In addition to that, we get chemical and biological ordnance training. At my level that I was at the time, we would be kind of the first guys in until the regional and national level could get there. So we would be the fodder, you know, to try and do everything possible to stop.
Mm. I should imagine the technology that goes into nuclear devices, perhaps maybe a dirty bomb, is pretty much gone off by the time you got there, I would think.
You hope so. I mean,
well, you don't hope so. I mean, let's rephrase.
Yes, no, that's true. Yeah.
It's unlikely that you're going to meet a nuclear bomb in a working environment.
Yes.
But a dirty IED with nuclear material in, scavenged from hospital waste, which apparently is a concern of the politicians in the military nowadays, that could be something that could turn up.
Yeah, and there have been, as you said, cases of IEDs, I believe it's in Afghanistan, with syringes that were infected with HIV/AIDS. Yeah, the ultimate goal is to prevent it from detonation and ultimately harm of personnel, property, or evidence.
It may seem to be counterintuitive, but would you like to still go back into that sort of business? Is there, for want of a better word, a buzz from it?
There is. There's a lot of adrenaline associated with it, but it is a niche market, and I feel I've got the skills, you know, to fulfill the requirements, but I am focusing now more on the safety side of things. I do have friends of mine that are in the oil field services industry, and they still use explosives, as they say, downhole explosives. So there is still a need for explosive safety apart from the ordnance realm. But there are still ordnance and explosive hazard mitigation companies, even some based here in the UK, that are still actively involved.
What do they do? Where do they operate?
Libya is the big one right now. They're still operating in Cambodia. A lot of the South Pacific areas, things like that. There's ordnance all over the place.
I believe the technical term for it is demining, isn't it? Is that something which you would like to go into?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I went down to Cambodia and Vietnam and kind of shadowed some of the technicians down there to see what they did. And it's very interesting. And I would definitely like to get involved with it in the future.
Where you haven't got a built-up area, are there any techniques like exploding airburst bombs and that which can actually explode a number of mines at the same time? I have seen the flail which goes around through the countryside trying to explode what's in front of it. Are there any techniques which enable you to dispose of ordnance en masse rather than one at a time?
There are certain tools, things like that. The MCLIC, which is essentially a rocket strapped to a 4-inch rope of explosive, is used by engineers in the military, and they'll shoot it out over a minefield and detonate it. And what that'll do is hopefully take care of more than one piece of ordnance at once.
Is that what they used to call a Bangalore torpedo? Is that?
It's the same basic idea, except now with a rocket, so they can extend the reach quite a bit further, but the same basic idea. However, like anything else, the cat and mouse game, there are some ordinances that have built-in safeties to prevent that detonation from that explosive shockwave.
So I suppose it's a mind game between the manufacturer of the devices and the people like yourself who are trying to make them safe.
Absolutely. As technology progresses, we of the EOD field get better and newer technology, but so do the designers and also the ad hoc designers, the makers of IEDs and things like that.
Do they still set bombs off by mobile phone ringing? Is that sort of, I see that on films, and that's the only reason, what, you know, not being a bomb disposer by myself, you can only see what you see. Is that a technique which is actually used in real life?
Yeah, absolutely. We recovered dual tone multi-frequency devices without getting down into the details. They still utilize it to detonate, but also to control that device, so they can arm it and disarm it or detonate it if they need to.
So effectively, the pulse, the tones that you hear on your phone when you press the buttons on the phone are used to decide what the insurgent wants to do with that particular bomb.
Essentially, yeah. It's just like when you call up your bank and punch in the numbers to be verified.
We were talking the other day about the Hurt Locker, which was a fictional representation of your trade. You did say, oh, you guys went to see it when it first came out. What did you think of it all?
We'd heard about this about 3 or 4 years before it came out, so we were all waited with bated breath. We saw it, and as any expert does, we picked it apart as we were in the theater, you know, saying, oh, that's wrong, that's not right, it wouldn't be like this. A lot of us were disappointed. Disappointed the way that they portrayed an EOD soldier as being almost psychotic and being kind of a loner, things like that.
Or there was in that film an adrenaline which made the guy want to go back and do it again, almost like he liked the gamble. I get that impression from yourself.
That is true. That is true. Some of those aspects are that were in there are true.
Although you chose the profession, there must have been a few times you thought, what the hell am I doing here?
There definitely were. there were quite a few. Driving down the side of the road with a known IED in front, listening to the radio because someone else had spotted it. And we couldn't find it. Couldn't find it for about 30 minutes searching with a robot. So we finally decided, I don't think there's anything down here. So we went down there and drove at about 2 miles an hour with all eyes out on the side of the road looking in our vehicle buttoned up. And we found it. And it didn't detonate, so we found it and backed off and we were able to take care of it. But that was one of those times where my toes were kind of curled up into my boots, you know,
It was... Yeah, it's today the day.
Yeah, and... But yeah, there were some close calls, but it was fun though.
Are these Mastiff vehicles? Is it the Mastiff vehicle? Or are these armored vehicles very effective against under road ordnance? Do they?
Yeah,
they
absolutely.
Do protect. Do they?
They're huge. I mean, they're fantastic. Absolutely love them. When I was there on my first tour during 2007-2008, during what they called the surge in Iraq, we first started getting these vehicles. For us, it was the JERV. Joint EOD Rapid Response Vehicle. And that was a vehicle specifically designed for EOD. It took the flat bottom of the Humvee and replaced it with a U-shaped hull. So all of a sudden, those explosive effects and shockwaves would go up
around
the vehicle. Exactly.
Simple, but effective. You think someone would have thought of that before?
Yeah. It saved so many people. We had this vehicle because we're exposed to the explosives quite a bit. In fact, one group of soldiers had approximately 500 pounds of explosive detonate directly under their vehicle. It flipped it up and over onto its back, and all personnel walked out. There would have been nothing left had that had been a Humvee. So it was very good to see the other soldiers finally get fielded those vehicles.
How do these depleted uranium shells work? Because that's a piece of ordnance which has been going for quite a long time. And also it's had quite a bit of a controversial history because there are concerns that maybe some of the personnel in the Gulf War and that actually suffered effects from handling those particular devices.
Mm-hmm. The DU, as we call it, is such a concern that we actually receive special training on how to deal with DU rounds, because we have to do post-blast investigations on how to behave and how to conduct ourselves within an environment that is contaminated with DU. It's called a SABO, and it's fired from, generally speaking, a tank round. It's basically a big lawn dart, and it's so dense, the kinetic force is able to penetrate through quite a bit of armor, through one side and outside the other.
There's no radioactivity involved in what you're trying to achieve with using it. It's just simply the fact it's so dense, it'll actually go through the material.
Yeah, it'll go through the material and it'll leave some dust and things like that from its entrance and exit.
And that's where you've got to be careful when you're actually in the area, because although nobody would admit it because they don't want to pay it any money, but there must be some personnel suffering from effects of that over time, because naturally if there's uranium dust in the air and they aren't pursued up and protected against it, they're going to breathe it in.
Absolutely.
And even just handling it, perhaps. It must be available on your fingers and things like that.
They do like chemically seal it. So as far as people firing it, but after it's been fired and people handling it, yeah, most definitely.
It's pretty public knowledge nowadays that some of the areas that the military wish to get at are deep-seated underground, and there are, inverted commas, bunker-busting bombs, without giving us a blueprint. The technique of that must be setting off charges all the way down. It hit the top of something, blow a bit out, then go down a bit more and blow another bit out, or is it just straightforward hardened steel all the way down through?
We never got any of the publications or anything for that advanced stuff. That would be like a one-off.
Leading edge.
Yeah. But yeah, that would require enormous amounts of technology in order to do that. It's definitely there, the technology. You'd be looking at a large, huge bomb with a steel tip, and made mostly out of steel, so it could penetrate deep down and have a special fusing system with the delay or...
But you also need some propellant, I would think, to keep it going down, because the mass of the ground would stop normally a bomb however far it goes down, but you want this thing to keep going regardless of the fact that the ground's stopping it from going.
That's true, yeah, and there are some rocket-propelled or rocket-assisted rounds as well.
And what about this other bomb which was used in Afghanistan? Again, it might be so esoteric that you never had access to it from a training point of view. And in fact, I think it's only been used quite rarely. It's the one almost close to the nuclear bomb, but it doesn't transgress that threshold. The thermobaric bomb, the one that actually takes all the oxygen out of the air.
It's essentially a kind of a fuel-air mixture. The bomb is dropped, it releases an explosive into the air, and once it reaches a certain level, then it will detonate and consume. It uses the oxygen in the air as its oxidization process.
So it's basically trying to kill people by suffocation, I suppose, in difficult areas.
Like, yeah, essentially in like the caves. Yeah, mm-hmm. In the closed environments. Yeah.
So where's life going to take you from now on, then?
That's a great question. I plan on being here for about 3 to 4 years here in the UK. And from there, we'll likely head back to the States.
Well, so, of course, if you finish your military service, you know it's come back.
Yeah, I'd love to.
On this program, we usually ask our guests for a choice of music. It'd be interesting to see what your choice of music would be.
I would have to say it would be Mars, The Bringer of War by Holtz.
been listening to Roving Report, produced and presented by Terry Meekin. For this week, we've been talking to A.N. Other, bomb disposal expert. Roving Report, radio for the community.